because she came in last Sunday with such enthusiasm to be leaving for Kenbrook Bible Camp for 3 days. And I happened to mention that she'll be gone for 3 days, thus I had nothing to do. Don't say that unless you're willing to take on some responsibility for filling that time. So my daughter was away for 3 days, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and I was in the Psalms. She has returned from Kenbrook, and it was great, and here we are today. So our reading for today, Psalm 39, Chelsea just read that for us, is situated loosely as a psalm of lament. Nearly one-third of the Psalter are lament psalms, either individual or communal, and most follow a basic structure that moves from plea to praise. And perhaps you noticed that by the time we read the final verse today, that Psalm 39 does not, in fact, end in praise. Rather, the ambiguity of verses 12 and 13 make it difficult to categorize this psalm. So, I'd like to offer us a method of reading Psalm 39 that shows movement by the psalmist from a place of silence to a place of speech. Many of the lament psalms serve as an example of how Israel finds its voice among suffering and despair. And Psalm 39, in particular, shows us that the psalmist refuses to remain silent before God. One author argues that it is indeed theologically necessary for Israel to engage in this practice of lament before God in order to be in relationship with him. Lament, in essence, not only allows, but also requires the human voice to speak out against any perceived wrong. So what happens when this doesn't happen? According to biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann, my number one favorite guy out there, it leads to coercive silence, he says. Really, it's a simple concept. There's a silencer and the silent, one with power and the powerless. In these psalms, we find that eventually the powerless, those coerced into silence, will break. Thus, these lament psalms can serve as a public witness to the people of Israel, offering them ways to bring pleas and complaints to God. Individuals find their voice, and from the underside, from places of depth and despair, they bring their petitions before God. Let's look again at Psalm 39 and begin to discern how this movement takes place. Chelsea helped set the stage for this when she read the text this morning. Perhaps you notice how sound, intonation, and expression all play a role in the reading and subsequent understanding of the text. So basically, we're going to do a verse-by-verse exposé with a couple of points drawn out. So we'll start again in verses 1 to 3. I'm reading from the NRSV. Your pew Bibles are NIV, but you can see follow along still if you'd like. So 1 to 3. I said, I will guard my ways that I might not sin with my tongue. I will keep a muzzle on my mouth as long as the wicked are in my presence. I was silent and still. I held my peace to no avail. My distress grew worse and my heart became hot within me. While I mused, the NIV here says meditated, the fire burned, then I spoke with my tongue. In verses 1 to 3, the psalmist wants to keep quiet, likely out of fear for who may be listening or watching, i.e. the wicked mentioned at the end of verse 1. In any case, the circumstance is forcing the speaker to remain silent. Another writer, not Brueggemann this time, suggests that if he cries out to God, wicked people might interpret it as a lack of faith or use it as an excuse to speak impertinently of God. We might do this too, not because we are wicked, but because we are hesitant to acknowledge or even experience the disorientation of life. But we read in verses 2 and 3 that the tactic, one of silence, creates a sense of anguish and unfulfillment, as evidenced in the speaker's hot heart. Then, the NRSV says the speaker mused, while the NIV translates these actions as meditated. Despite feeling silenced, the thoughtfulness of the psalmist serves as the spark of new energy which propels him into speech. The text does not tell us how long this musing lasts, but I imagine that the flame is enkindled after repeated incidences of frustration. Have you ever held your speech for so long that you, too, have experienced this feeling of fire? Maybe it was a response to an injustice you saw, or perhaps it was an outrage as a series of events. By the end of verse 3, we know that while the speaker wants to remain silent, he cannot. So for me, after reading this psalm and rereading this psalm many times since Monday, I've come to the realization that I do a lot of musing. In fact, I'm quite good at musing. I live in the world of thinking and dwelling on possibility. But then sometimes that doesn't quite lead to where we're going to get to next at the end of verse 3 about speaking with my tongue and then addressing Yahweh. But I was thinking in the context of musing this week that for off and on, I would say, for about the past 10 years, I've spent some time thinking about issues related to migration and people on the move. I've had lots of experiences, and I've done some writing about these things. But by and large, I have sort of been at rest, perhaps, in that place of musing and thinking. However, I would like to hope that as we move through this psalm, I can see some parallels to how that might change. And in fact, starting next month, there will be some opportunities that I can bring to the church in terms of migration and advocacy, because I am the newest member, I guess you could say, of the MCC's Volunteer Advocacy Coordinators Network. So if you have advocacy work that you would be interested in, please see me about that. So verse 4, turning point here, away from 1 to 3. So verse 4 says, "Lord, let me know my end, and what is the measure of my days? Let me know how fleeting my life is." We'll just keep going 5 through 6 too. "You have made my days a few handbreadths, and my lifetime is nothing in your sight. Surely everyone stands as a mere breath. Surely everyone goes about like a shadow. Surely for nothing they are in turmoil. They heap up and they do not know who will gather." In verse 4, Brueggemann says, the speaker names Yahweh for the first time. In that moment of bold address, things already begin to change. The cause of trouble has now become an open question in the relationship. He has decided to speak, but the words lack trust and are full of despair. The speaker appears perplexed at the seeming transience of life. After all, the measurement of a handbreadth is just the distance across 4 fingers, about 3 inches, thus implying that life is short. And in verses 5 and 6, we see a series of accusations. Surely, surely, surely. Surely everyone stands as a mere breath. Surely everyone goes about like a shadow. Surely for nothing they are in turmoil. Interestingly, mere breath in verse 5 and nothing in verse 6 both translate from the Hebrew word havel. The word will occur once more before the end of the chapter, and it expresses the psalmist's feelings of despair. The same word, havel, is found in the familiar passage in Ecclesiastes when the writer pronounces, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Life is void of meaning for the psalmist. The nothingness representative of the antithesis of creation. So while the psalmist does speak in these verses, the words, and likely the speaker himself, are empty. Overall, this psalm is a wonderful demonstration of what it means to express emptiness. Have your prayers, like this one, ever felt empty, as if speaking empty words into a void never to be received by anyone. After all, nothing changes, and you are left wondering, to what end do I even attempt to speak? If so, this is Havel. Verse 7, "And now," declares the psalmist, is the turning point from past to present. "And now, O Lord, what do I wait for? My hope is in you." Here, the speaker's speech is emboldened again as he directly addresses Yahweh for the second time. He asks this question, "And now, O Lord, what do I wait for?" It's easy to interpret "wait" here in a temporal sense. I might imagine my daughter asking how long she might have to wait for dessert to be served after finishing dinner. But in this text, I encourage you to read the word "wait" in a way that conveys expectation. For example, "And now, O Lord, what do I expect?" Reading verse 7 in this way, in light of the accusations we just read in verses 5 and 6, shows us that the speaker is bringing great concerns to God. The psalmist is empty, powerless, and the bar of expectation at this point is probably set rather low. Yet, expectation awaits. The psalmist hasn't given up, given into Havel, the nothingness. It is clear that the speaker expects change. I think that by understanding this, we can truly see the difference between waiting and expecting. Simply waiting for a new opportunity to drop in your lap is far different from expecting a change in the current narrative. The former is easy. The latter requires work and faithfulness. In fact, I'd risk asserting that we would rather simply pack up and move to greener pastures when challenges arise, when we are in the darkness of lament, than to persist in our current narrative. Moving place allows us, all of us, to continue managing and controlling our own situations. Socially, we often have the means to do this, and culturally, we are taught to censor our experiences around strength and victory. But if we truly believe in expectation in the way the psalmist uses it here, then we know God has the ability to enter in and change the narrative. When I read verse 7, I imagine the psalmist knows, some place beyond his current despair, that Yahweh will indeed respond. By addressing God, the psalmist is doing two things. First, he is asserting his trust in God as a source of deliverance. Now, this might sound odd or misplaced, a misplaced move after such an accusatory tone that we just read. And commenters say that verse 7 is an example of the ambiguity humanity often feels towards its relationship with God. On the one hand, the psalmist desires to trust God in all things. But what happens when trust fails? Or, as the psalmist argues, when the source of trouble points back to Yahweh? The other side of ambiguity lies in the need to speak or voice concern. Perhaps you can relate to this. Wanting to trust versus having to speak. If so, consider how ancient Israel would approach this dilemma. Again, Brueggemann argues that Israel and its faithfulness has nowhere to go except Yahweh. Israel in need must talk to Yahweh. An example that he gave in a video sermon that I watched of him, he gives the analogy of a parent and a child, where the child is completely and utterly dependent on the parent, but for whatever reason, the child is mad at the parent. This never happens in my house. No, I'm just kidding. And so no matter what, the child still has to come back to the parent. even though he or she is upset and at some point has to voice and bring that concern. So again, Brueggemann says, Israel in its faithfulness has nowhere to go except Yahweh. Israel in need, when they need something, when things aren't going well, they must talk to Yahweh. He goes on to describe this as a challenge to covenantal monotheism. Israel's polytheistic neighbors, those nations surrounding Israel that have many gods, don't face the same dilemma. If one trouble is attributed to one god, then simply appeal to another god to fix the wrong, right? Makes sense. You could do this too in your house. If your mom says no, then you go to your dad and they'll give you the candy or whatever it is, right? Since Israel has pledged a monotheistic faith to one God, Yahweh, uncertainty and doubt may arise when humanity feels as if it's lost its voice in the presence of the divine. With this understanding, it becomes easy to see why the psalmist struggles to find his voice, even halfway through the psalm at this point. The second thing the psalmist does in verse 7 is to declare that in asking the question, he is insisting that things cannot and will not remain the same. Change must occur. By declaring, "My hope is in you," in the second part of verse 7, the psalmist answers his own question. He has moved from silence to speech, and in doing so, he sets up for the imperatives he will bring in verses 8 through 11. So, verses 8 through 11. Deliver me from my transgressions. Do not make me the scorn of the fool. I am silent. I do not open my mouth, for it is you who have done it. Remove your stroke from me. I am worn down by the blows of your hand. You chastise mortals in punishment for sin, consuming like a moth what is dear to them. Surely everyone is a mere breath. These imperatives, deliver, do not make, remove, they're verbs, and they're in verses 8 and 10. Deliver, do not make, remove. They're urgent requests to God. This language shows us that the speaker has acknowledged that everything, up to his very life, is at stake. The psalmist is helpless, at his lowest point, yet has found his voice and can offer petition. In these verses, the speaker is legitimating his desire to reject the old narrative. Not move to a greener pasture, but to reject his current narrative and demand for change. In his book on the Psalms, J. Clinton McCann says that we find an articulation of despair and hope simultaneously. As the psalmist accuses God for his trouble at the end of verse 9, for it is you who have done it, yet declares hope back in verse 7. The text continues, you chastise mortals in punishment for sin, consuming like a moth what is dear to them. Surely everyone is a mere breath. For the third time, the psalmist uses the Hebrew word havel. This is not insignificant to note. One might jokingly ask if the psalmist simply could not think of another word to use. But from a literary perspective, the frequent usage of the word conveys to us that the psalmist deeply embraces havel and is likely on the precipice of its meaning, non-existence. Verse 12 is the plea. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not hold your peace at my tears. For I am your passing guest, an alien like my forebears. Again, notice the literary tactic here. Just like in verses 8 to 10, three clauses guide the psalmist's cry. All important verbs again, listen for them. Hear, give, do not hold. Despite his own silence at the beginning of the text, the plea asks God not to remain silent. So you have a bit of irony there. He's quiet in 1 to 3, but he's asking God in verse 12 here to not remain silent. Do not hold your peace the psalmist says, means to say, do not not speak. The desperation becomes evident. The plea for God to intervene, apparent. In fact, the psalmist likens himself to a passing guest. A better translation from the Hebrew here might be resident, alien, sojourner, someone living in a land with no rights. When the psalmist uses this imagery, he is telling God that not only is his life transient, but while on the journey, he is feeling exposed, vulnerable, and dependent. The plea is heartbreaking. And I imagine us all as sojourners in some manner. It's a highly undesirable place to be. Undeniably culturally, and perhaps theologically, we tend to place little value on exposure, vulnerability, and dependence. Don't we naturally seek the opposite? Permanence, security, even citizenship? At times, God calls us to be the uncomfortable sojourner. And the only way I know the psalmist's painful plea in verse 12 is because I have walked in his steps. Actually, a couple of us have. There were four of us back in October of last year that had the opportunity to participate in the MCC's Borderlands tour, and then we had an opportunity to tell you about that after we returned. But again, after reading and rereading Psalm 39 throughout the week, when I got to this verse 12 and this wandering of the sojourner and the heartbreaking plea, I continually thought of the migrants walking through the Sonoran Desert, the very desert that we walked to as well. Finally, we arrive at verse 13. Turn your gaze away from me, that I may smile again before I depart and am no more. It's an abrupt shift from the plea in verse 12, and it provides no resolution to the psalmist's despair. Robert Alter translates verse 13 this way. Look away from me that I may catch my breath before I depart and am not. I like this translation better, especially the phrase that I may catch my breath, because to me it offers a bit more hope here at the end of the text. Clearly, the psalmist is overwhelmed at this point, but the language of catching one's breath takes us down the path of recovery, creation, and new life. If he does indeed succeed, he will move forward with a faith transformed. Now, by way of theological reflection, I'd like to again focus on the movement from silence to speech in the text and offer three considerations for you to ponder. Perhaps you will resonate with one or more. If you don't speak, if you remain stuck in verses 1 to 3, then you will remain in a state of havel. You are silenced, powerless, and to some degree oppressed. Have you ever been silenced? Silenced by someone in a close relationship, or perhaps socially or corporately? How did you find your voice? There is power in speech that comes from below. Just as the psalm expresses, speech is wrought with language that is abrasive and raw. I encourage you to lean into the text and through an act of bold faith acknowledge your silence. As Brueggemann reminds us, everything must be brought to speech, and everything brought to speech must be addressed to God, who is the final reference for all of life. Next, the psalm shows us an acted out covenantal drama. In this drama, there are two actors, us and God. And throughout these 13 verses, we see the ebb and flow of the drama. From the silence of the speaker, followed by complaint, petition, and plea, the psalmist finds his voice. And in his relationship with God, there is space. There is space to express displeasure, disappointment, and even anger. Remember that in verse 9, the psalmist blatantly says, "For it is you who have done it." We can be assured that Yahweh is present in the drama. And although the psalm does not conclude with praise, as is most typical of lament psalms, we learn foremost that speech is both necessary and risky. The good news is that in these psalms are the full expression of human experience. The speech of each psalmist gives us a visible event between two actors. Human experience is authenticated, and potential of transformation is made possible. Lastly, embrace the Psalms of Lament. Don't be tempted to read these psalms as acts of unfaith or failure. Rather, acknowledging the powerful role they play in the life of ancient Israel can equip us, modern-day readers, from a place of silence to a place of speech. When this occurs, Brueggemann tells us, that such a faith is indeed a transformed faith, one that does faith in a very different God, one who is present in, participating in, and attentive to the darkness, weakness, and displacement of life.